KGST Fresno 1600 AM.
This is a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM, so please stay tuned.
Listen to the Portuguese American Hour on Multicultural 1600 AM. Hear in-depth conversation about Portuguese culture and learn everything happening in the valley within the Portuguese community. Listen Wednesdays from 4 to 5 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Portuguese American Hour here on our second edition. Yes. I'm Justice Neves, here with Dennis Borges, of course. And we have a guest in the studio today, Dennis, yeah?
We do. We are very excited to have Richard Machado. Mr. Machado is a native of the Azores who has been for a while now in California. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking time. I know you're quite a busy person with a very successful business in agriculture, and agriculture has been part of your life for a long time. Tell us a little bit about your story of immigration. I know that you and your family, your dear brother that everybody loves in Fresno, still loves, Fred Machado, and how one comes from Flores to the Valley.
Well, it's a long story, but filled with a lot of exciting points along the way. Our first connection was my grandfather, my father's father, actually came here originally, received his American citizenship papers in Shasta County in 1883. And from that beginning, he eventually returned to the Azores, married, and my father was born. Like many of the some of the early immigrants, the intent was to go to America, make money, come back, buy more property, and make a better quality life in the Azores. But then he went back. My father was born, and because my grandfather had been a naturalized American citizen, my father, because of birth, became a natural, natural-born American citizen. So my father then returned as a young man at about age 21. With he and a couple of friends, came to California, and at that time to the Bay Area. I think he was here prior to the Golden Gate being built, actually worked on the ferries when the ferry system was a big enterprise in the Bay Area. And so same intent was that make some money, go back, make a better life. He did go back, wasn't married at the time, but then went back, married my mother, and then stayed there for a while. And had five children, almost one after the other, a couple of years, Fred being the oldest of that first crop. And then with five children, he needed more money and wanted to buy more property. So he comes back to America to work, works actually in the shipyards in Berkeley at the time, learned the trade of welding. And of course, that was at the time that World War II basically had broke out. So my father remained here for 6 years. All during the war years, where back in the old country was his mother, a brother, and my mother and five children. And with that, they he continued to send money, take care of the family, help with adding with, you know, to have some labor to help my mother in the fields.
Right.
And so after the war, he returns, and then that's when you know, I'm born, a crop of long passionate separation from mom and dad. And I think
it was a special trial.
Yeah. So my dad really, I think, there was no question. I think after that second time here, being here during those war years, really saw that now he had these young children, and he had infants, and I think he thought that, you know, that if we're going to make a quality of life, we need to go back. So he then brought us back, and we, in that same segment, like my father before us, because of his citizenship, we were all natural born citizens. And although my mother was not, when we did arrive finally in California, we came to the Fresno area, into the valley, because my father had only one sister, and she happened to be living in Fresno County. And I think my dad wanted to be near family, to be near family.
Sure.
I think if he was single with my mother, or even early on with my mother, probably would have preferred the Bay Area, but he did come to Fresno, and we moved into the Easton area where his sister lived. And so we began then that life, and on a small little farm. Although my dad did work most of his life in the steel industry because of his trade that he had learned in the Bay Area, but I think the rest of us had that little, that sense of agriculture from the right. very beginning, and I think that was probably inbred in us back in the Azores.
Right.
That we continued then, to be absorbed in the Portuguese culture here at the time, the festas, the get-togethers, the families, all of the traditions. I can remember as a young boy being involved in making linguice in the old days, actually killing the pig, taking the blood in for the ladies to make marcellas, and it was quite an experience, one that I really value today. But it was a... And so as we progressed, I was first to go to college.
I was going to ask that. I know that you went to college. You were the first in your family.
Yeah, and at Fresno State, and graduated from there. It was a good experience, and met a lot of people.
And then you got into the agricultural business. I know that you did some public service work as well.
I did. I served the governor of California, Pete Wilson. I always had a little political inkling, always mm-hmm. liked it when I was in college, served in student government, and did that all the time, and there was just a little tug
right.
in that area. And I then had an opportunity to serve in the senior staff of Governor Pete Wilson. And
was it something with agriculture related or no?
No, I did. I actually got spent time internationally, spent a lot of time actually a couple of times in Portugal. I was director of the Trade and Commerce Agency and predominantly focused on ag, the ag sector, in the sense of growing and developing businesses that could add value to agricultural products. That everything from food processing to distribution to anything that enhanced the ag community throughout California, from avocados down in San Diego to horseradish up in Siskiyou County. So we had a good experience, and we had several trade offices at the time overseas. I had an opportunity to visit those. I went with some high-tech sector people into Portugal, actually, when the new Tagus Industrial Park was being developed right outside of Lisbon mm-hmm. in its infancy. So after my return, I came back kind of to my more domestic life, but being around my brothers in ag and seeing all of a lot of compliance documentation that was needed by people in agriculture, very frustrating but cumbersome. I formed a company with a young partner who I'd met in the Wilson administration, a very young, smart partner, and we together formed a company starting with one employee, and we're today at about 160 employees. And we're fundamentally an agricultural technology company. We provide a platform to address regulatory compliance, food safety, both with companies and at the field.
Your connection with the Azores, though, although you came very young.
Mm-hmm. Came at age of two.
Age of two. So, I mean, you didn't remember basically anything.
I did not.
What was your first time going back? Do you recall?
I went back about a little over 30 years ago. I remember getting off of that SATA plane and actually kissing the ground.
Wow. Fantastic. But you had no memory when you.
No, I had no memories. But my
but
mother,
you had, of course, but your I had mom, a lot of your
we
parents.
Had, yeah. We had a lot of relatives. My mother wrote regularly, And the things today when you see about the technology, how quickly today, as those of you who've been following maybe this Hurricane Lorenzo know, there was severe damages in parts of the Azores, and particularly to my island of Flores. The port at Lige was devastated, but we were looking at real live photos of that, and I can recall my mother writing a letter that sometimes took 6 weeks to go back and forth. It might be the passing of a relative that we didn't know about for weeks. There were no those communications.
But she kept that constant contact.
Constant, all the time. And what I can still recall, even as a boy of 10, 12 years old, when the letter arrived, my dad was usually at work during the day. When he got home at night, first thing was sit at the table, my mother would open
A family affair.
And read the letter. Read the letter aloud.
As cartas da Américas, we called it there when we were.
Encomendas, the man. We would say encomendas. I drove my mother to the post office many times where we put clothing together in sacks and fill out all these
papers to help the relatives
and send them over. We'd sometimes buy a new pair of jeans for relatives there and send clothes over. Times were pretty rough there, but. But from my first time going, it was an instant love affair. Of course, that was where I was born. That's where I was baptized. That's where I learned to walk. And I continued to, we spoke Portuguese at home virtually all of the time. I'm sad now that in a sense that I regret that maybe I didn't learn to read and write as well as I could have with my mother, because she was very well schooled. And although I continue to practice my Portuguese, and I get along really well. I always tell, and I may just use a little phrase in Portuguese now. I always tell my people when I arrive, "Es sempre pedir para comer, beber e dormir," and if you didn't pick that up, it's I know enough Portuguese to ask to eat, to drink, and to sleep. And if you can do that, you can survive.
Tell us a little bit. I know you're limited for time, and we appreciate you taking the time to visit with us, and we hope that this is just the first of many visits here in Fresno. You're local, and that's great. And you have many, I think, not only stories, but also wisdom to share with our viewers, our listeners. Tell us a little bit about your experience with the reason why we're doing this show, which is the Portuguese Beyond Borders Institute. You've been one of the strongest supporters. You were just recently interviewed for a project that we're doing for the oral history, the video that's going to be archived in our Henry Madden Library, but also hopefully a project for a television documentary. How did it feel to be interviewed and talk about in length, basically, not in just a few minutes, about what you do and who you are?
Well, I felt very honored, first of all, to do that, and I know there's a lot of wonderful people who have also been interviewed, and hopefully there'll be many more. I think the project itself, in terms of its context, is so important because I don't think there's anyone that I know of today, anyone around me even listening to this broadcast today, that if you couldn't go back and maybe speak to your parents, to your mother, to your father, and ask questions that you may not have asked, wouldn't just love to do that and to hear it firsthand. And we can read about things. We can read about historical parts and events of the year, but there's nothing like hearing it directly from the people. And so as this project goes forward, I'm hoping the priorities are that they go to the most elderly people first.
What do you have to do?
To do that. I don't feel I'm that elderly, so I don't hope you
were selected as one of the baby ones.
So I was, I happened to be at the first, but certainly I think going forward, I think that probably needs to have a good priority. Because there's wonderful knowledge of both.
Lots of them have left us already, unfortunately.
Yeah, they have. Yeah. And I think without question, I was saddened that my brother Fred wasn't among that, because he had not only a great knowledge, but he had a memory that to his last day was phenomenal. And could count stories. He knew every relative in every city that you could travel through.
Richard Machado was our guest, and we thank you so much for spending some time with us, and we hope to see you again here in the Portuguese American Hour, and thank you for all you do to keep this cultural life in this fascinating area, because a lot of times people think about the Portuguese community in California and they don't think much, you know, there's these little pockets that are well known, but Fresno and Easton has a story that's really unbelievable as I discover it.
And there's a good connect. I know we have, we're limited on time, but I'll just ask the, you know, the listeners out there, if you're not engaged or don't know a lot about the Institute, Portuguese Beyond Borders Institute at Fresno State, you really need to dive into that. And actually there is, there's a project to raise some funds to, to promote this story telling, and I encourage you to go there, go to the website, donate, because this will be something that you, your children and your grandchildren will have forever.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you for joining us. Sorry about that. So we're just letting Richard out of the studio right now. Dennis, I know you had a book of the week.
Yes, we do.
Is that what I heard?
Yes, we do. We have a book of the week with a little bit of music to bring the mood. And we thank Richard so much for being here with us and his lovely wife. The book of the week is called Stormy Isles, and it's originally published in Portuguese in 1944. It is set in the Azores between 1917 and 1919. It focuses on a vivacious and sharp woman by the name of Margarida, who at 20 years of age is a model of the feminist aspirations and the paragon of her generation. A member of the elite, she foregoes some of her entitlements of her class and struggles with the morals of the bourgeoisie society in which her life unfolds. Narrated in a very realist and poetic language as a series of interconnected tales within a larger plot, Stormy Isles provides the reader a rich, vivid portrait of the Azores in the earliest 20th century. It was written by a writer by the name of Vitorino Nemésio, who was born in 1901, died in 1978. He was a novelist, a short story writer, a poet, an intellectual, a journalist, and a radio and television personality. Known as one who could really converse, much like our prior guest, Richard Machado, and he is considered one of the most significant Portuguese writers of the 20th century. The book was obviously written in Portuguese. It was translated to English. It's available from Tagus Press, and it was translated by a good friend of mine, Francisco Cota Fagundes, who is a professor emeritus of Portuguese in the Department of Language and Literatures and Cultures at the University of Massachusetts in Dartmouth. I think it's a very important book for those who want to know what it's like to be an Azorean, what it's like to be living and raised in a group of islands. So it's called Stormy Isles by Vitorino Nemésio, translated by Francisco Cota Fagundes, an Azorean tale that we invite everyone to take a look and to read it.
Sounds great to me. So just wanted to touch on the book again very fast. It's multiple tales.
It is. I mean, it's a one story. It goes around the story of Margarida, but there is intertwined with multiple tales that bring the larger tale all into a story. I think that anyone who wants to know what it's like to be an Azorean, even if your great-grandparents came from there and you've always wondered, you know, why are these things the way? It kind of explains a lot of the things that how people feel the way they are because of the different things that they had to live with. You know, it has a very high energy book, and it tells of a particular family, but it can be many multiple families that lived in the Azores, especially in the beginning of the 20th century.
Okay. So with that, we're going to take a quick break. We will come back with a Azorean poem, correct?
We will come back with an Azorean poem,
and
then we will also do an interview as well. We will have our second guest, which is Angela Costa Simões, who is the president of PALCAS, Portuguese American Leadership Council of the United States. Stay tuned.
Listen to the Portuguese American Hour on Multicultural 1600 AM. Hear in-depth conversation about Portuguese culture and learn everything happening in the valley within the Portuguese community. Listen Wednesdays from 4 to 5 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Adelaide was born in Nordeste, São Miguel, Açores, from a family of immigrants. Adelaide came to the United States in her teens, where she did her graduate studies in literature. She then completed her PhD in Portugal. She taught many years at the University of the Azores, and she is a published poet, and the poem I'm going to read basically talks a little bit about the Azores in a lot of different ways. And here it is. In the grimace of the dark night slashes the scream of life, In the volcanic and cold earth, it looks all the way around. Mountains, underneath, the earth trembles. Above, vertiginous clouds. The hesitant steps balance themselves on the ground. The mountains rise and fall, and the clouds dissipate. The arms that stretch within the elevation are crucified, and then suspended feet challenge the volcano. The earth trembles, and everything is shaken and demolished, and the scream, captive in the heights, in a hymn, illuminates all. Kind of a, what the Azores are all about as being nine volcanic islands in the middle of the Atlantic.
Yeah, wow, those descriptions are very vivid. I was able to picture pretty much all of that. That was great.
Very intense. Adelaide is a great poet. We miss her dearly. We will feature another poem next week. But now we have a guest on the phone with us directly from Northern California, one of the most active Portuguese Americans in not only California, but throughout the United States. And that is the chairperson of the boards for the Portuguese American Leadership Council of the United States, PALCAS, my good friend Angela Costa Simões. Angela, how are you?
Doing well, thank you, Denise. How are you?
I am doing great. We are here in our second edition, and our first two guests, we had Richard Machado, and now you are our first guest also on this program. Thank you for taking time to visit with us, and let's just dive on into PALCAS, because I think it's okay. We have so many organizations. We are blessed with that in the Portuguese American community throughout California and throughout the United States, but PALCAS is unique. Tell us a little bit about it, please.
It is very unique, and thank you for the opportunity and congratulations on this radio hour. Quite an accomplishment. It's something that I think I wish we had more of throughout the state, throughout the country, so congratulations. But yeah, so PALCAS is really the only national organization that advocates for the community at the national level. And what does that mean? Well, when we first started back in 1991, some of our early accomplishments were making sure that Portugal was part of the visa waiver program, and that means that if your family wants to come visit for a wedding or for the summer or, you know, for any other reason, they can just buy a plane ticket and come over. They don't have to go through the process of getting a visa. And so that obviously makes travel much, much easier. We also helped push through a tax treaty between U.S. and Portugal that had been floundering for many, many years. And we worked with Congressman Richard Pombo at the time. And that tax treaty meant that if you had any sort of income from Portugal,
did we lose?
Did we lose Angela?
Angela was. I don't know if Angela's still there.
Go ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Come on back. We lost you for about 10 seconds there.
Oh, you did? I'm sorry.
That's okay. We're back. You're talking about the treaty. So, that's great.
Yeah, just that essentially the establishment of the treaty, it means that you won't get taxed twice on the same income. So that's a good thing.
Right.
And, you know, over the past 28 years, we have evolved our program to include education initiatives, such as an internship program where we send students to Portugal for an internship, summer internship. We have a scholarship program. And then we've also done some other things to provide the government with data about our community. So, for example, we did the first national survey of the community where we asked people, would you consider yourself Hispanic? Because at the time, this was about 8 years ago, at the time, the Census Bureau was seriously considering, as part of the census form, to include Portuguese as part of the Hispanic count. And there was really no data to say whether or not that was accurate or not. There's lots of anecdotal data and opinions, but no data on how the community felt about that. So we did the survey. We had over 8,000 responses, and it was overwhelming that Portuguese do not identify as Hispanic. So when we presented that data to the Census Bureau, you know, they said thank you very much, and we're fairly convinced that that was the big reason why they dropped the idea of lumping us in with Hispanic community. And then now we're also doing the PALCAS Index National Survey. We're on our second edition of that. It's the only source of national data on the community that finds out where do people spend their time, what's important to them, what are some of the issues that are important to them, what do they worry about. Do their kids speak Portuguese? How did they learn Portuguese? Do they go to Portugal? All these things about our community that will help us plan for the future, right? So
correct.
What kind of programs do people want? Why, you know, what's the point of putting on a program if no one cares about that particular issue? So these are things that, this is data that's going to help all of our organizations plan for the future.
As a national organization, you know, we are known in the Portuguese American community for having lots of little organizations. This is a big organization, involves all states, mm-hmm. all Portuguese Americans, of not just immigrants, but first, second, third, and even fourth generation. What are some of the challenges that you see as a national organization, but that Palcos has been able to overcome in order to exist all these years?
Yeah, I would say the biggest challenge is visibility and just communicating to people and raising awareness about what exactly that we do. You know, we don't have halls in
correct.
All the local communities.
There's not a physical place, yes.
There's not a physical place that people go. We don't
right.
have cultural centers or things like that. So,
right.
you know, a lot of times when people donate, they know that their money is going to go to support the hall or to, you know, the upkeep of the hall or something like that. So when they donate money to us, they think, well, my money's just going out into cyberspace. And really, it's going to support. So we do have one paid staffer that sits in Manassas in the small office. And then the rest of the work is actually done by the board, as you know, Denise, because you're on the board as well, and you know how much the rest of the board members roll up their sleeves and actually get some work done. And so I think the biggest challenge has just been awareness. And so as a result, we've started to have mixers and local events, and we take the gala to the communities as opposed to always having it in Washington, D.C. And so we're trying to have more touch points with the local communities so that they can see us and know who we are and know what we do.
The connections with Portugal, of course, can be done at a local level, but at a national level, it has another impact. How important do you feel Palcos's role in having this relationship, this transatlantic relationship between Portugal and the United States, and what has Palcos done, as you mentioned, with the visa waiver program, but are some of the projects that you're thinking that will continue to foster this relationship? And how Palcos can play an important role in something that doesn't have to be all governmental.
Right. No, it's very important because, you know, it's a big community. And when the Portuguese government is looking to the bigger community and how to support us or what kind of resources to provide, whether that's teaching the Portuguese language or, making visits to Portugal more accessible, things like that, they need points of contact, and Palcos has served in that role many times. I think that one of the biggest initiatives we have going right now is the Make Portuguese Count.
Yes, talk a little bit about that to us, because that's very important, coming up on the census, correct, 2020?
Yes, absolutely. Yep, it'll start on April 1st of 2020, and it'll run for, I forget exactly how long, but you have, I think, about a month or two to fill out the census. It's important for people to realize that in 2010, the census of 2010, we were not counted at all as a community. So if you look up data and try to look up Portuguese in the 2000 census, we essentially didn't exist. The only way we have data about our community is because of the American Community Survey. It was a much smaller subset that survey that's conducted a few years after the official census, and it's only about 15% of the population that they survey. And so with this census, what's going to happen is we actually have a code where Portuguese is going to be tabulated and the data analyzed. And we even have subcodes for Azorean and Madeiran that will fall under Portuguese. But people actually have the opportunity to claim ancestry if they so choose to. Now, again, it's important for people to understand this is a choice. We're not mandating that they do that. We're not saying that you should or should not. We're saying that it's important for our community to have an accurate count, and there is now the facility to do that. And why is that important? Well, let's take Portuguese language, for example, and that we always say we wish we had more Portuguese language programs, even in public schools. You know, they offer Spanish and German and all these other languages, and Portuguese is the fourth most spoken language in the world. Why is there no Portuguese? Well, we need to show numbers. We need to show that there's demand in the community. We need to show that, you know, in certain districts, in certain populations, there's enough interest and enough demand to merit, you know, having a Portuguese language program in a school. And so we can't do that if we don't have the numbers, and we can't do that if we're not counted. So that's why the Make Portuguese Count effort is so important.
Yeah, we'll be touching on that. I think that's one of the things that we here at the Portuguese American Hour are going to have multiple conversations with you and with Marie Fraley and everyone who's involved in the Make Portuguese Count campaign. A little bit about the gala. You talked a little bit about this event. It's an event that recognizes Portuguese Americans from various fields. It's something that Palcas has been doing for a very long time. And this year, coming up here in about a week on the 12th, it's going to be in Sacramento, so it's coming back to California after many years. Tell us a little bit about the gala, and when was the last time it was here in California, by the way, Angela?
The last time it was in California, it was in San Diego, and it was about 6 years ago.
Okay.
And the time before that was in San Jose, so this is the third time it'll be held in California. It's kind of a special thing for me because, as many people know, I'm from Sacramento, so it's in my hometown. And I've got my whole family on the committee to help out.
Yeah, you made them all join the committee and work.
I wrangled them in. I sure did. I'm particularly proud of this gala because it's a whole weekend of events. And some of the organizations and individuals that we partnered with, I feel, is such a strong example of collaboration and what we can do if we all work together, right? So on Friday, we have our reception, and we partnered with Sox Vacations and CPAC as well to host that reception, where we'll be showcasing a movie that's being made about one of our historical figures, Peter Francisco. So that's going to be
exciting. Who was in George Washington's army, correct?
He was. He was known as the Hercules of the Revolution. George Washington, known as the one-man army, I believe. So then on Saturday, you know, we, of course, have our members meeting, but then, again, we have partnered with CPAC, and CPAC is hosting the R, and I would say R because I'm on the board of CPAC as well, third annual summit, the third or fourth, I can't remember.
Yes, it's our third, correct.
It's our third, which is one of the only events that brings together Portuguese-American elected officials in the state to discuss how do we encourage more Portuguese-Americans to join public service. And so we'll be talking about things like how do you run a campaign and what's that like and what does it take and hearing from other elected officials on their experience. And then also talking about Make Portuguese Count. In the evening, we have the gala where we have 14 awardees I think it's our most ever. And it's one of those things where we could have an awards gala for the next 200 years and still not recognize everybody that truly deserves to be recognized. So we really try to recognize the folks at the local level who, you know, are keeping those halls going, who are keeping the Portuguese language programs going, who have dedicated their lives essentially to keeping the culture alive in our communities. And then we also recognize some national figures that through their notoriety are letting the mainstream know that Portuguese are talented in every way, right? So someone like Joaquim de Almeida, who is a famous international actor. Yes, we need people to know that Portuguese are everywhere and we're successful in every field, right? So through people like that, and you know, Meredith Vieira has been honored in the past, and so people like that are also important for us to recognize. And then on Sunday, it's a nice relaxing day, but we're going to visit Carvalho Family Winery and St. George Winery and have lunch there. And so, again, expose some of our guests to the Portuguese-American winemaking tradition that has stayed here in California. So quite excited for the whole weekend.
It's a wonderful program. And for our listeners here in the San Joaquin Valley, there's a few folks from the Valley being recognized. One of them, Lucio Noia, right here from Fresno, who is a cultural and Portuguese icon in this community. Lucia is loved by everyone, as she should be, for all of her work and all of her generosity. And also Isabel Cabral Johnson, who is a superintendent in Hillmar, just north of Fresno here, who has one of the Hillmar Unified has probably the exemplary Portuguese language and cultural teaching programs in not just California, but throughout most of the nation. So, Angela, we have just a couple of minutes. I just wanted to thank you, first of all, for taking the time out from your busy schedule. You've been, you're kind of like the superhero of Falcus. You're like Wonder Woman with Superman and all the, and all of those, and Batman and everyone put together. Thank you so much for all you do. Your energy is really inspiring. And one quick 30-second plug for those young people who are listening to us who are of Portuguese background or who are not, but who are interested in Portuguese. What should they do to get involved in this community and these traditions that we treasure and we want them to continue?
I would say figure out how you want to get involved. What do you think needs to change? And start talking to people and volunteering, because believe it or not, the organizations do want youth involvement, and they do want young people to come in and share their new ideas, because without them, our traditions will ultimately die off and there won't be anybody to continue them. So I would say just put yourselves out there. And then as far as TACUS is concerned, you know, we are actively looking at putting together a youth ambassador program, and we're still figuring out what that looks like. And so, you know, if anybody wants to provide some input or be a part of the forming of that, we would love to hear from you. And, you know, hey, it's a good resume builder.
That's right. And lastly,
Lastly,
how can people get a hold of TACUS? I mean, how can they go online? What's the website, please?
Website is www.palcus.org, and the email is just as easy, palcus@palcus.org.
Okay. Well, thank you, Angela. Thank you so much for taking time, and we'll be seeing you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dinesh.
So again, thank you, Angela, for joining us on the phone. That was a great interview, very informational. I will definitely be checking out the TACUS website, making sure I find a way to stay involved. So right now we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we will have our...
Moments in history,
yeah,
right?
Moment in Portuguese history. So stay tuned.
Listen to the Portuguese American Hour on Multicultural 1600 AM. Hear in-depth conversation about Portuguese culture and learn everything happening in the valley within the Portuguese community. Listen Wednesdays from 4 to 5 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
And welcome back to the Portuguese American Hour. Once again, I am Justice Nev, sitting with Dinesh Borges, of course.
Yes, here we are.
So we have our first moment in Portuguese history.
Here we go. So we will talk a little bit today. Our moment in Portuguese history is Afonso I. He is also known as Afonso Henriques. He became also known as Afonso the Conqueror. In Portuguese, Afonso o Conquistador. He was born in 1109, between 1109 and 1111, we were not sure, in the city of Guimarães, which is the birthplace of Portugal. We do know for sure that he died on December 6th of 1185 in the city of Coimbra. He is the first king of Portugal. He reigned between 1139 and 1185. He conquered Santarém and Lisbon from the Muslims in 1147 and secured the Portuguese independence from Leon in 1139. Afonso VI, at the time Emperor of Leon, which is a province in modern-day Spain, had granted the county of Portugal to Afonso's father, Henry of Burgundy, who successfully defended it against the Muslims between 1095 and 1112. Henry married Alfonso VI's illegitimate daughter, Teresa, that happened a lot in those times, and who successfully defended it against the Muslims. As I mentioned, he married Teresa, who governed Portugal from the time of her husband's death, which happened in 1112, until her son, Afonso, came of age. She refused to cede her power to Afonso, but his party prevailed in a battle called the Battle of Batalha of São Mamede near Guimarães in 1128. Though at first obliged as a vassal to submit to his cousin Alfonso VII of Leon, Afonso assumed the title of King of Portugal in 1139. By the victory of the Battle of Ourique in that same year, he was able to impose tributes on his Muslim neighbors, and in 1147 he further captured Santarém, and availing himself of the services of passing crusaders, he successfully laid the siege to Lisbon. He carried his frontiers beyond the Tagus River, which is a famous river that crosses Portugal, annexing the city of Beja, a current-day city in Portugal, in 1162, and also Évora in 1165. In attacking Badajoz, he was taken prisoner, but then released. He married Mafalda of Savoy and associated his son, Sancho I, Sancho I, with his power. By the time of his death, he had indeed created a stable and independent monarchy. He was the first king of Portugal and responsible for creating the Portuguese nation, Afonso I. So that's our moment in Portuguese history for today.
All right. So with Afonso I, at that point, it was only mainland Portugal?
Correct. It was the Azores and Madeira had not been discovered or rediscovered, according to some people. They were discovered, or there had been Phoenicians and Carthaginians there. But to the quote-unquote modern-day Europeans, they were not discovered. They were discovered in the 1400s. So that was actually not even the total geographical area of Portugal, mm-hmm. but it was the birthplace in Guimarães, the birthplace of Portugal. And so with him becoming the first king of Portugal, then the country was established. It was called the Kingdom of Portugal because Portugal was a kingdom until 1910.
Nah.
So we had kings for the biggest part of our history.
Yeah. So that was your moment in Portuguese history. Moving on now, we have some events.
Correct. As tradition kind of rules around here, the Portuguese American Hour, the last 10 minutes or so, we're going to talk about Portuguese events in the Portuguese American community and, of course, in the Portuguese Beyond Borders Institute. Mm-hmm. And our first one that we have that I mentioned briefly last time is on October 14th. That's coming up pretty soon, a week from this coming Monday.
Yeah.
It's called Portugal, the European Union, and the Transatlantic Relations. It is a talk given at the University Business Center, Peter's Building, 191, the auditorium. It's featuring Rita Faden, who is the president of the board for the Luso-American Development Foundation, FLAD. And she will be talking about the European Union, the role of Portugal in the European Union, and the importance of the transatlantic relations between Portugal, Europe, and the United States. The lecture is free of charge. It's open to the public, the parking lot number 6. It's, again, as I said, the Peters Business Building, and it will be a week from this coming Monday, October 14th, free of charge at 6 p.m. So we're hoping to see everyone there. The auditorium takes about 150 people. We'd like to see it full.
Of course.
We also have an event by the Portuguese Beyond Borders Institute coming up in the South Valley in the city of Tulare. It's called Vozes. It's called Sharing Our Portuguese American Oral History Project, Bringing the Past to the Present. It's a way to present the oral history project that that Richard mentioned in our first interview, mm-hmm. To the community in the South Valley, in the Tulare, Visalia, Porterville, Hanford area. It's free of charge. It's a joint venture between the Institute and the Tulare Joint Union High School District. It's at their staff development room at their head office, October 22nd at 7 p.m., so we want everyone to join this public forum about preserving the Portuguese-American legacy in the Valley. Lots of information will be given, coffee, refreshments, and desserts. So, you know, there's some free food as well.
Of course.
And it, like I said, it's a partnership with Tulare Joint Union High School District. So that's coming up. Another event, and this one coming up real soon, and now this weekend, is in the Portuguese community. So we'll turn from the Institute to the community. Mm-hmm. The 73rd, can you believe that? 73rd
oh, wow.
annual celebration honoring Our Lady of Fatima will be held in the 5th and the 6th, so this weekend in Tulare. Saturday the 5th, there will be a candlelight procession at 8 o'clock. Then the representing of the presentation, that is, of the past presidents, queens, and the crowning of the current queen, followed by folk dancers from the Tulare High School students, where I taught for many years, where I began this folklore experience, now continued by one of my colleagues, Belinda Feijó, for 15 years when I was there for 2.5 decades. Uh-huh. 15 years of that we began Portuguese folklore teaching, and the students have continued with that, and that'll be presented on Saturday at about 8:15, followed by a dance until midnight. Then Sunday, they have the annual parade at 10 o'clock to the church. There's a high mass, and then the traditional sopas will be served at around 11 o'clock and throughout the afternoon, as long as there are people that want sopas, and then again in the evening time. And then at 8 o'clock, it's the traditional Grand March, which is a big event in the Portuguese American community, where the queen is presented, her attendants, the queen's courts, her escorts, the committee. So it's a pretty interesting event. If you've never attended one, these are free of charge, and please do. It's in Tulare. President of the Festa is Jeff Beck, Vice President Ray Ferreira, Secretary Joey Vieira, and Treasurer Doug Souza. And here in Easton, we'll talk about that with further details next time. But here in Easton, we have here in Fresno, the community of Easton, as I mentioned last time, on the 12th and the 13th. It's also the Our Lady of Fatima celebration, and it will go on all week long with a prayer session, with the prayer of the rosary. But the big 2 days are the 12th and the 13th, and there will be also lots of different events. So put that down in your calendar, and next week we will feature the entire program as we did today for Tulare. So do put that in your calendar. October 12th and 13th, the Our Lady of Fatima celebration in the community of Easton, just here next to Fresno. And also the 12th and 13th, for those a little bit out west here in the valley, also within the listening area of our community here of Multicultural 1600, we have the City of Los Banos, which will also have its Our Lady of Fatima celebration at their Portuguese Hall and Church, also on the 12th and the 13th of October. More details also next week. So these are some of the upcoming events that we have here for the Portuguese community in this area. And Justice, I think it's important to let the community know, if they get a hold of me, everyone in the valley knows, and they can go through the institute, through my email, through my through the different outlets, social media, etc. Mm-hmm. If they will let us know, of course, the events, we'll be more than happy to talk about the Portuguese community events throughout the valley that are coming up. There's going to be quite a few of them coming up. So hopefully we get everyone involved and everyone to participate in this array of traditions that have been held, as we saw here, the 73rd anniversary of the Fatima celebration. I mean, it's been a long time.
Mm-hmm. Of course, we want to spread as wide a net as we can possibly cast within the Portuguese community and anybody outside the Portuguese community that's correct, just interested and want to learn more.
Sure.
So I know you said it's a 73rd annual, and you were involved with it for 2.5 decades being there in Tulare as a teacher.
I was involved with getting the students to dance folklore at the Festa, because it was a way to kind of expose what we did in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And so for 15 of the 22 years that I taught there, I had it's Portuguese 4 or 5. This tradition does continue, like I said, with my colleague. We taught students. My largest class was 48 at one time, but in the 15 years, we had 582 students who learned Portuguese dances.
Oh, wow.
Many of them not of Portuguese background, many of mm-hmm. them Hispanic background, many of them of Anglo-Saxon, whatever kind of ethnicity, African Americans, Asian Americans. But it was a way to promote the language and also the culture and getting them involved. I mean, it's one thing to learn about a dance, it's another one to have to actually perform it.
Yeah. So I just wanted to ask real quick, from when you were initially involved in it to now, or even when it just first started, how much have you really seen that grown? Like, I'd imagine from the beginning to now, there has to be some sort of growth.
Well, when we began the folklore experience, it was a way to teach it, and it was just a small group of students. But in the beginning, we thought that many students might not be interested, but they were. And the class grew and grew and grew. And like I said, 3 years ago was my largest class. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago was my last year of teaching. 3 years ago, I had 48. 2 years ago, I had 44. And it's usually anywhere between 35 to 40 students. The Festa itself, when it began 73 years ago, I wasn't around at that time, or even here in the valley, or even around in the world. But I'm old, but not that old. But the Festa, I believe, began as a fundraiser for the Catholic school that exists here at the parish, and like any event, it started small, but now it's a whole week event, and especially concentrated on Saturday and Sunday, and it's a good way to keep these traditions alive in the Tulare community. It's still one of the Tulare's biggest Portuguese festivals, the Festa de Fatima this weekend. Yes.
Yeah, got it. So with that being said, we do have a little bit of time. We wanted to tease a new segment that we're going to be introducing next week.
Correct. We're going to be introducing next week, but it's a segment not just for me and for Justice. We don't want to do this ourselves. So we want you to be involved, our listening audience, and I've already been in touch with a couple of people, and I hope to be in touch with a few more. And it's a segment about recipes. We think that one of the rich traditions of any culture is the food. And so when we go to a different country, we always like to try the food. And we have all these different cultures in the valley, so why not bring the food to live here? And so we will start a recipe, a Portuguese recipe of the week. I will share some of my own that my mom and my dad passed on to me. I love to cook. That's one of the things I love to do. I think I'm a pretty good cook, probably sometimes a better cook than a teacher, but anyway, that's a different story. I do love to cook, and I do love to try different recipes. And the Portuguese have some unique ways of doing some things. So we'll be sharing these recipes, some very traditional ones like massa cevada, Portuguese sweetbread, some not so traditional. But we're hoping to have every type of recipe shared, you know, one per week, done in a brief way, you know, and then these will be put up in our website. They'll be digitalized, and folks can go to the multicultural website 1600 and see, you know, these recipes and actually try them themselves, whether you're Portuguese or not. And so we're hoping to have some people who love to cook share them with us. So here's a calling to those of you listening: get a hold of me so you can be featured. We will can do it through the phone, obviously, like a 3 to 4 minute segment where you tell us, you know, what the ingredients are, how to prepare it, and why you like the recipe. And we hope to have also some of the Portuguese traditional cooks and chefs, you know, from different parts of California that we wanted to have a little segment and talk a little bit about, you know, their own creations, you know, beyond some traditional recipes. So that'll be starting next week.
That sounds great. And of course, like you said, he's going to post them up. We're not just going to make your mouths water listening to us talk about it.
Right.
You'll have your chance to try to make it. Just real quick, what was your favorite or most memorable dish growing up?
My favorite dish is still one of my favorite dishes. It's called alcatra, and I'm not going to tell anyone what it is. So I will just leave you as that. You might want to Google it. You know, nowadays, we can Google anything.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite dish is a typical dish from the island I was born and where I was, as I mentioned last week, where I was raised until the age of 10. It's called alcatra. It's done in other regions, but it's very, very typical of the island of Terceira. It's a meat dish, and we'll talk about it. Maybe we'll start with alcatra.
All right, sounds good. So once again, this is our second edition of the Portuguese American Hour. Again, just want to thank our guest, Richard Machado and Angela Simores.
Mm-hmm.
All right, cool. I just want to make sure I got that right.
You said it right.
So we thank you for being our first guest on our show, and make sure you tune in next week.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
This was a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Listen to the Portuguese American Hour on Multicultural 1600 AM. Hear in-depth conversation about Portuguese culture and learn everything happening in the valley within the Portuguese community. Listen Wednesdays from 4 to 5 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.